From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Dale Thronberry.
Good morning, America. How are you? My name is Dale Thronberry, and I will be your host this morning on Veterans Radio on a beautiful winter's morning out here in Michigan. The sun is shining, finally.
Spring has sprung.
I think so.
Spring has sprung.
For all of us out there that don't like the idea of being cold all the time, I think we finally made it. We've got a great program for you this morning. Joining me in the studio in just a moment is a young lady who has distributed over almost 10,000, probably more than 10,000 over the last couple of years, Christmas cards to our troops overseas. And also in our control room today is our air boss, Bob Gould. Good morning, Bob.
You're right. You're airborne. You're airborne all the way. One, two, three. How about that?
He can be such an embarrassment sometimes, you know.
Hey, airborne. You never forget.
That's true. You do. You never forget. Those of us who have, you know, have been in the military, you do not ever forget any of those things. But pretty much all of us can name our drill sergeants or TAC officers or whoever it was that was out there. Our program today is we're going to be talking with helicopter pilots again. This is part three of our series on pilots. And today we're going to be talking to gunship pilots. Now, we've got two Cobra pilots from the Vietnam era. We've got Randy Zahn, who has got a book that he's published, and we're going to be talking with him in just a little bit. It's called Snake Pilot. He was a Cobra pilot in Vietnam in 1971, 72, and also a really interesting story in the second half of the program, another Cobra pilot named Mike Brown. And Mike Brown was also in probably, it sounds like, pretty much the same area of operation. And in his Cobra, and the tail boom was blown off of his Cobra, and he's going to talk about how he got that thing down to the ground. I'm still not sure how he did that, but I think it's going to be exciting. We encourage you to give us a call if you've got stories about gunships that you want to talk to us about. Give us a call at 877-573-7825. That's 877-573-7825. We're also looking to talk to crewmen and door gunners and people like that. So if you've got a story that you want to tell us, give us a call. Or just give us a contact, and we'll do a special program just about you. But now we're going to talk a little bit about some fundraisers that are going on out there. And, Bob, you've got one from somebody who was on our show a couple of months ago.
Yes, yes, I do, Dale. The Pride and Honor Flights of Michigan, that's the group that takes veterans down to Washington, D.C. to look at the memorials. Down there, there's no fee for the veterans that go, so that's all volunteers and all volunteer money. However, they do have to pay for the plane. So they're holding a fundraiser, that's right, at the Big Boy Restaurant on Zeeb Road and I-94. That's just about 200 yards north of 94. That's, of course, in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Now, when is that going to be, Dale?
I don't know. When?
Well, that will be Tuesday, February the 26th from 5 to 8 p.m. Once again, Tuesday, February the 26th from 5 to 8 p.m. at the Big Boy Restaurant on Zeeb Road in I-94. There, volunteers for the Pride and Honor flight will be serving. That's right. They're going to be serving and helping, waiting on customers and all that. The tip money, et cetera, is all going to go for the Pride and Honor flight. What a good organization.
It's a great organization, and one of our partners, Ken Rogge, went with them in the fall down there as what they call a guardian, and I think he went down there, I think he said probably somewhere close to 100 veterans that they took down to see the World War II Memorial. It's a great organization, and you can find information for them on our website and also on the internet at prideandhonorflights.org. You can go from there. Okay, joining me in the studio right now is an incredibly talented young woman, much younger than I had anticipated, but and her name is Destiny Eady. And Destiny has sent out over 10,000 Christmas cards to our veterans in Iraq. Destiny, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hi.
Hi. Come on in a little bit closer. Destiny, tell me how you got started with this idea.
My dad's coworker, his son was in the war overseas, and I asked if he would like a Christmas card. He said, yeah, go on to anysoldier.com and you can look him up and get his address and see what he needs, what he wants. And I did, and I read some of the other people's entries on what they needed, and they just wanted Christmas cards from back home.
And so you just decided to start doing that?
Yeah.
What grade are you in?
I'm in seventh grade.
This is a seventh grader. Somebody tell me that our youth are misspent, you know, in all our years and so forth. What a great idea. And where do you get these cards from?
Some of them have been donated to me, and other times we buy them. I spent babysitting money, and my mom and dad have bought a lot of them for me.
You were telling me a little bit earlier about a corporate sponsor, more or less, that has given you a lot of cards.
IKEA. All their cards that they didn't get sold last year, or they didn't sell last year, they donated to me.
How many... last year you sent out 7,000 approximately?
7,406.
Okay, and what is your goal for this year?
This year my goal will be 10,000 cards.
How much does it cost to send these overseas?
I get flat rate boxes, and I can get about 300 cards in a box. And the box costs $9.10 to ship, no matter how much weight.
Mm-hmm. And these cards are going to individual military people, or are they just kind of like a bulk thing and they just get distributed?
They're a bulk thing and they just get distributed.
Okay. I think it would be great. We were talking earlier also about, you know, in different conflicts where we didn't necessarily get a lot of mail from home. Mm-hmm. I just think this is a great idea. Really just we want to remind the people that they can get, they can help you out. How can they help you out?
They can send any letters or anything that they want to me. I'm Destiny Edie, P.O. Box 324, Belleville, Michigan, 48112-0324.
Okay, that's Destiny Edie, and that's E-A-D-I-E,
mm-hmm.
Right? P.O. Box 324, Belleville, Michigan, 48112-0324, or they could send you an email where?
At cardsfromdestiny@yahoo.com.
Okay, that's cardsfromdestiny@yahoo.com. And you want to send out 10,000 this year.
Yep.
Which is, I think, a very worthwhile goal. And again, Destiny, I can't tell you how excited I am to just meet you, because I've heard so much about you and what a great thing that you are doing. And I'm hoping that people out there will support you and send you, you know, cards or money, whatever it is that you need to get this project even up higher and higher. And if somebody wanted to do this in other parts of the country, they could probably just send you an email also, couldn't
mm-hmm.
they?
Yes.
Okay.
Dale, could
yes.
we put that link up on our website?
We can put her address. We will be putting her address up there.
Cool.
And get that to her. You don't have a website yet.
Not yet.
Not yet. Well, I'm sure maybe there's somebody out there that would be more than happy to help you set one up for nothing.
Here, here.
They are always out there. With Destiny, I want to thank you so very much for being on Veterans Radio, and I want to congratulate you again on what a great thing that you are doing for our troops out there.
Thank you.
And I wish you all the best. Thank you. Hey, Bob, we're going to go back into our Welcome Home right now.
Okay, well, thanks, Dale. Welcome home each week on Veterans Radio. We welcome home servicemen and women who, in the service of their country, have been stationed around the world and are returning. Dateline, Staunton, Virginia. The approximately 130 soldiers of the Headquarters Company, 116th Infantry Brigade, representing Virginia Army National Guard units from Staunton, Virginia, were welcomed home at the Staunton Armory. Dateline, Aurora, Colorado. Members of the Colorado Air National Guard, 140th Wing, were being honored with a welcome home ceremony. Dateline, Boise, Idaho. Member of Idaho's 321st Engineer Battalion, who served in Iraq, were given an official welcome home by U.S. Army officials. Dateline, Paris, Texas. Paris, Texas welcomed the 952nd Engineer Company Combat Support Equipment of the U.S. Army Reserve, their home from Iraq, at a Welcome Home Warrior Citizen Award ceremony Saturday at Paris High School. Welcome Home each week is sponsored by the Marine Scholars Program of Ave Maria University. For more information regarding the Marine Scholars Program, visit them online at avemaria.edu. That's avemaria.edu, or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. That's 239-280-2552. Welcome home.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill. The benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
How many of you are suffering from some kind of chronic pain? If you are, then you're just one of millions of people our age who just live with it. I strongly suggest that you give Quantum Physical Therapy a call at 734-483-9200. Quantum Physical Therapy is a multifaceted facility providing cutting-edge conventional and alternative rehabilitation services. The highly qualified and friendly staff at Quantum are the movement experts and are committed to coming up with a specific solution for your specific problem. Whether it's pain, weakness, swelling, nerve injury, amputation, disease, or age-related morbidity, they can help you lead a productive life. Quantum Physical Therapy has two locations, one at 5417 Whitaker Road in Ypsilanti, and the other at 6180 Michigan Avenue in Saline. That's Quantum Physical Therapy, 734-483-9200, or on the web at www.qptherapy.com. And we're back on Veterans Radio, and today's topic of conversation are gunship pilots or snake pilots, and mainly Cobra pilots today. Joining me first on the program is Randy Zahn, and Randy is the author of a book called Snake Pilot, and Randy flew Cobras in Vietnam with the 1st Squadron and 9th Cav in 1970 to 1971. During his tour as a young, very young, even younger than I was, warrant officer, 19-year-old warrant officer, Randy earned two DFCs, Distinguished Flying Crosses, two Air Medals with V device, two Army Commendation with V device, and something that I just read in the book last night I'm sure you must have gotten a Purple Heart of. Randy, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
And I greatly appreciate you coming on and talking to us about your book. To let the audience know a little bit about what we're going to be talking about, I was also a pilot, a warrant officer pilot in Vietnam. I flew Slicks, but I was also a Red Hat at Fort Walters. And as I was reading Randy's book last night, Red Hat is just a class designation, the big red one. And it was very interesting to read that whole thing. I was suffering flashbacks all night.
I hope they weren't too painful.
No, they weren't. Actually, you know, in reality, they weren't. My wife has pointed out, and probably a number of other wives out there with veteran husbands, you know, did you all have such a good time? No, but we, you know, those are the parts that we want to remember.
Exactly.
All right. Well, Randy, tell me a little bit about how you got involved being a pilot. I thought that was a good story.
I've wanted to be a pilot since I was probably 5 years old. That's all I ever wanted to be. My aunt came out to California from New York, and I remember going to what used to be Lockheed Airport with my parents to pick her up. It was really the first time I remember being up close to an airplane. I asked my father, you know, how did the airplane get here? And he said, you know, kind of like a bus has a driver and a car has a driver, you know, an airplane has a driver, too, called a pilot. And I just looked up at him. I said, that's what I want to do, and I grew up. And I've never changed my mind, and I'm still doing it today.
Are you? What do you do now?
I still fly internationally for a corporation.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, tell me how you got into the Cobra program, because a Cobra was a relatively new aircraft when I was in Vietnam. In fact, I think it was being brought into country while I was there in 68 and 69.
Right. I graduated from high school. I was going to college in Glendale, California. And I had asked, back in those days when the recruiters used to come and talk to the seniors classes about, you know, which service was the best, and to come to join, they talked about the warrant officer candidate program. And I spoke to the recruiter after the assembly had broken up, and he basically said, just go to college and get your degree because it's, you know, we've got like a 3 or 4 year waiting list. And so I had gone on to college, and I remember I was driving down Brand Boulevard in Glendale, California by a recruiter's office, and at that time there was a poster up of a I don't know if you remember the Cheyenne, the AH-56.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a big poster of that, and it really caught my eye, so I just went in and started talking to him. And he said, there's no waiting list. You know, I can get you in, like, tomorrow. So I just started taking all the tests and physicals that were required, and I was on my way.
I should point out that the Warrant Officer Candidate Flight Program, you didn't have to be a college graduate to get into it, and I believe that the program is still the same. You don't necessarily have to be a college graduate to become a pilot in the Army anyway. And it was a great program for a lot of us out there. It allowed us to get in and actually fly when other people didn't want us to.
Absolutely.
All right, so we end up going down to Fort Polk, Louisiana, because that's where they sent all of us. And from there you went to Hunter, or after Fort Walters, you went to Hunter.
Correct.
And going through all the flight schools, you went through the Huey and all that other stuff, but then you got to fly the Cobra. Tell us about the first time you saw one.
The very first time I saw one was actually at Fort Walters. There was a Cobra that landed at the PX pad up there on the hill, and that was the first time I really saw one, you know, up close and personal, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sold. I was hooked.
Well, when you went to advanced flight school at Hunter to transition into the Cobra, kind of give our audience an idea of the difference between, say, a Cobra and the regular Huey.
They're based on the same airframe. The big difference is the Cobra. First of all, it was the very first attack helicopter ever designed. But the Cobra is only about 39 inches wide at the widest point, which is the engine nacelles.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a pretty confined little aircraft. It's a tandem aircraft, so the pilot sits in the back and slightly above the co-pilot gunner, who sits in the front. So you haven't got a lot of room to move around. I mean, you can't get up and walk around and enjoy yourself. But
true.
It was air-conditioned, which was nice. Everybody thinks it was a luxury, but in actual fact, when the aircraft was first introduced into Vietnam, they had some of them that had actually crashed because pilots had passed out from heat exhaustion being in that enclosed canopy.
Oh, I think, yeah.
It got really, really hot in there without the air-conditioning unit. But, yeah, highly maneuverable. It was kind of like the fighter of the helicopters at the time, and it was just an awesome aircraft to fly.
The Huey, you really didn't want to go over 120 knots in that. How fast could you go in a Cobra?
The VNE on it was 190 knots. That's the maximum speed you could do, and it would normally do that in a dive, which is about 213 miles an hour. And although I remember pulling out of some rocket runs at in excess of 200 knots indicated,
mm-hmm.
and the aircraft would just pull out. It was very, very smooth. I mean, you had to apply the right application of controls at the right time, but it would come out without shuttering, and it was just an amazing aircraft.
I have a friend who flew them, and he echoes exactly what you're saying about how smooth it was and how you were able to. And plus, you had to be your own mechanic.
Yeah, that's the one disadvantage that we had is that virtually every other aircraft in the inventory flew with a crew chief, whether it was a Loach or a scout ship, you know, the Hueys as you flew, Chinooks or anything else. Cobra school included 2 weeks of maintenance training because, as you say, we did have to be our own mechanics. It was either, you know, fix it or you might end up sitting out in the jungle waiting for a mechanic to come, which wasn't always pleasant depending on where you were.
Mm-hmm.
So we did a lot of our own maintenance work.
Okay.
And that's certainly not to take any credit away from our crew chiefs, because we had some awesome crew chiefs, and I know mine, who actually lives about 5 miles from me now in Washington. But without him, I probably wouldn't be here.
I think we could all, you know, echo that again also, that our crew chiefs are the ones that kept us in the air on a regular basis, because they
were
throughout the night.
Absolutely.
You know, and in our case, our crew chiefs, even after working throughout the night, they're going to have to get on the next day and continue to fly with us.
Yeah.
And all right, so we've transitioned now into the Cobra, and we're on our way to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And you end up getting assigned to the CAV, which was not your first choice, I understand.
Correct. I was as much as I wanted to be a gunship pilot, I wanted some kind of guarantee that I was going to come home, and of course there wasn't any of those. But I just I was 19, and I think like all of us, we arrived there and I was scared. I mean, there's nothing else you could say. You know, you go into a combat zone, you're going to be getting shot at, and you know, it's kind of a frightening feeling. I had heard about the first of the nights from a lot of people saying they're, you know, just a bunch of renegades and they're crazy. And most of the units, when they got into contact, would call, you know, the ARA, or they would call artillery, or they'd call the infantry. And because we were basically the eyes and the ears of the CAV, I mean, we were actually, Vietnam was not a traditional war. I mean, we didn't have like a front line established.
Right.
So we were always out way ahead of our troops, actually looking for targets for the ground troops to move in on and exploit so they wouldn't be wasting their time. So quite often we would get into contact and there was nobody around to help us. So it was either, our motto was we fight them where we find them, because if you didn't, you know, they'd be halfway back to Cambodia or North Vietnam by the time we got, you know, troops there to engage them.
Right, and you know, the CAV has always had somewhat of a reputation out there, and so you ended up with a CAV, and you were in 3 Corps up where at Phuc Vinh, correct?
That's correct.
And for those of that are not familiar with Vietnam, it's kind of divided into 4 areas, South Vietnam, and this was in the 3 Corps area, and this was north of Saigon, and other parts of you were pretty close to the Cambodian border, and you flew in a lot of areas that I was familiar with in the Quan Loi, Tay Ninh, mm-hmm. Hudap areas.
Mm-hmm.
And you would go out in your hunter teams, or your pink teams, as they called them.
Right, hunter-killer teams.
And where did they come up with the pink team? Because obviously that doesn't sound quite as masculine as it should.
Well, the concept was we had 3 platoons. The gun platoon was the red platoon. The scout platoon was the white platoon. So hence you send one red and one white, and you got a pink. And then our lift platoon, which was the slicks, were the blue platoon. So if we went out with one of each, and we did at times, because some of the areas we were in, if we were going to take fire, we kind of had our own internal infantry. That was kind of an elite unit. Mostly experienced combat veterans that kind of distinguished themselves, and they got recruited into the blues. So if we had a bluebird with us, we became a purple team.
Okay. Could you kind of quickly explain what your job was as the hunter, especially if you were in the front seat, or the difference between the jobs of the front seat and the aircraft commander?
Yeah, we were actually the killer of the hunter-killer team. I mean, the Loach was the hunter who was basically on the ground, on the deck, literally hovering at treetop level, and their whole sole purpose in life was basically to get shot at so we knew where the enemy was.
People don't understand this. I'm talking with Randy Zahn, author of Snake Pilot, flying a Cobra attack helicopters in Vietnam. The Loach is the little egg-shaped helicopter, and their job was to go down among, as he's just pointed out, and hover around on the trees until he could find the bad guys, and the bad guys hopefully would shoot at him, and then you would come into action, correct?
Correct. They would normally throw out a red smoke. They would yell, taking fire, and we would be able to tell the tail of the scout ship was painted white, so we could see them, in olive drab colored aircraft over the jungle is not always easy to see.
Right.
So the Loaches were usually painted with either like a day-glow orange, or in our case, our tails were white, so it's easier to see. And 3 things would happen almost simultaneously. You'd get a scout ship, or the pilot would yell, taking fire. You'd see a smoke, and then the white tail would disappear as the nose of the aircraft went down. The tail would kick up and basically disappear. And at that time, basically, we just rolled in, and we were initially shooting minigun just to keep their heads down, because to shoot rockets, you actually had to aim the aircraft. I mean, the rocket pods themselves were not articulated in any way. They were just fixed on the wing store, so you actually had to point the aircraft at the target. And sometimes it took a few seconds to get everything set up. So the minigun was in a turret in the nose of the aircraft, and the co-pilot gunner who sat in the front had control over the turret. So his job would be initially, just to keep the bad guys' heads down so the scout ship can get out of the way, and then we can get the aircraft turned and, get the rockets on the way.
I'm always amazed when I read stories about you guys and what you did, and the idea of the pilot in the front, his job was to keep track of where this little Loach was, and the little Loach, when it flies around, is sort of like a bumblebee, and you had to continually keep circling and hopefully being able to see where these guys were.
Yeah, well, you know, when you start flying with the same pilots often enough, you can actually read the aircraft. I mean, the scouts did not carry maps. We didn't want their maps blowing out, you know, the enemy getting a hold of it, because we had all the areas of operation outlined on there. We would have the friendly positions on there. We might have, you know, a shackle, which is a code to basically to mask radio frequencies, et cetera, et cetera. So the front seater, and I was a front seater for the first 5 months there. I mean, there's a lot that you have to learn about the mission before you become an aircraft commander.
Mm-hmm.
So the front seater really becomes an absolutely expert navigator and map reader, because we had to put in airstrikes, we would put in artillery, we would vector in medevac aircraft. We often put in combat assaults. We might start out with just ourselves, you know, the two aircraft, mm-hmm. and end up with Chinooks and aerial rocket artillery and shooting artillery and Air Force and combat assaults and everything. And the Cobra aircraft commander who was on the mission was the mission commander.
Oh, okay. So there was a lot of responsibility for any pilot. Most of you were young.
Yeah, it was an enormous amount of responsibility. It really, you know, I think back now, and it's kind of like, I mean, I remember my wife, we went to a reunion several years ago, and we were driving back to this friend's house that we were staying at, and she was just kind of looking at me, and I said, "What?" And she says, "You guys were like John Wayne."
Yeah, and sometimes we felt that way, too.
Well, we did. You know, we were young, and I think a lot of us felt like we were bulletproof. And, you know, when you watch, I think that's probably the biggest transformation I went through, is when you see your first friend get killed.
Mm-hmm.
You realize that, you know, we're not playing games over here.
That's very true, Randy. Again, we're talking with Randy Zahn, author of Snake Pilot Flying a Cobra Attack Helicopter in Vietnam. If you'd like to join in the conversation, give us a call at 877-573-7825. Well, Randy, I don't want to give the whole book away, because I think it's a great read, and I appreciate your publicist getting it out to me as fast as she did. I spent all night reading it. It was one of those books that I couldn't put down. But tell me about... I guess the mission that was most important to you, or part of that was most important, was the Cambodian invasion in 1970.
70, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I got there. I got to the unit about 2 months before we went into Cambodia, and it was really the first time that we actually got to go after the enemy. They, you know, they had sanctuary set up along the borders of Cambodia, and of course, the North always said they did not, but we knew they did. But, you know, they would come in and they would shoot their artillery or, you know, attack one of our ground troops, and they would basically just melt back into the jungle and go back where we couldn't touch them. So, you know, President Nixon back then basically said, go and get them. So, I mean, for us, it was an absolutely wonderful opportunity, you know, because we were pretty much for the first time really on the offensive.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we found enormous amounts of, you know, weapons, supplies, foodstuffs, hospitals. You know, we did them a lot of damage. And despite what the newspapers were saying over here about protests and those of us that were over there didn't want to go, and I mean, nothing could have been further from the truth, certainly in our unit. I mean, we were literally fighting each other for seats in the aircraft.
Mm-hmm. And I think that people, you know, don't quite understand that once you are into the combat situation, you want to do the job the right way and get it done, so then you can go home.
That's right.
And I think that's one of the issues. We've got about a minute until we come up to the bottom of the hour here. And so how long before you were able to transition to become the aircraft commander?
Let's see, I got into the unit. By the time I actually really started flying, it's probably the last week of March, and I made aircraft commander in August. So it was about... just about 4 months.
You flew an awful lot of hours, though, in those 4 months.
I flew a lot of hours, yeah. I was actually grounded a lot. We were only able to fly, I think it was 120 hours a month,
mm-hmm.
Before we were grounded for fatigue. And I know my first 30 days of flying, I was grounded for like 6 days for fatigue, and I still flew like 176 hours in that first 30 days.
Wow. I want you to hang on, Randy. We'll be right back in just a moment. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Hospital apprentice Fred McGuire, after emptying his rifle, used it as a club. Details after this.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy?
For freedom.
Freedom of religion.
What America stands for.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy?
For honor.
Everybody. And watch out for everybody.
Freedom to vote.
Democracy.
Freedom to go outside and play with my kids.
I joined the Navy to serve my country.
Every freedom that we have.
The right to raise our kids in peace.
My little brother.
My wife.
My kids.
Our children's children.
The United States Navy.
It's not for ourselves alone that we serve.
While attached to the USS Pampang, McGuire was one of a shore party moving in to capture Mundang, Philippine Islands, on the morning of 24 September 1911. Ordered to take station within 100 yards of a group of huts close to the trail, McGuire advanced and stood guard as the leader and his scout party first searched the surrounding deep grasses, then moved into the open area before the huts. Instantly, the enemy opened point-blank fire on the exposed men, and approximately 20 enemy charged the small group from inside the huts and from other concealed positions. McGuire, responding to the calls for help, was one of the first on the scene. After emptying his rifle into the attackers, he closed in with his rifle, using it as a club to wage fierce battle until his comrades arrived on the field, when he rallied to the aid of his dying leader and other wounded. Although himself wounded, McGuire ministered tirelessly and efficiently to those who had been struck down, thereby saving the lives of two who otherwise might have succumbed to enemy-inflicted wounds. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Schrader Yacht Sales, the East Coast's finest dealer of Chris Craft, Island Packet Yachts, Packet Craft, Parker Fishing Boats, and Nautic Star Boats. Schrader Yachts is located at the top of Barnicot Bay in Point Pleasant, New Jersey. Our good friend Ray Schrader provides you, the customer, with over 30 years' experience in boat sales, sail and power boats, both new and used. Schrader Yacht Sales offers a full-service storage facility and a reliable crew responsible for all of your boating needs. Specialists in electronics, they can accommodate your needs for radar, autopilot, air conditioning, GPS, heat, and communications. Give Ray a call at 732-899-8010. That's 732-899-8010, or go to SchraderYachts.com. That's SchraderYachts.com. Oh, by the way, tell Ray you heard about him on Veterans Radio, and he will personally deliver your new boat from Schrader Yachts anywhere there's water. Schrader Yachts, ready to serve all of your boating needs.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Pat the Handyman and his team is ready to help you with your remodeling, repair, and painting projects. Call Pat the Handyman at 734-260-1158. That's 260-1158. Pat the Handyman is a veteran-owned business.
Len Pitlack, CPA, is an award-winning consultant for the U.S. Small Business Development Center. Let him use his 25 years' experience to bring you, as an individual or small business owner, his professional and courteous tax and accounting services. Give Len Pitlack a call today at 734-993-1313. And we're back on Veterans Radio. We're talking with Randy Zahn, the author of Snake Pilot, flying the Cobra attack helicopter in Vietnam. And I want to take a quick break here. We've got a call from Mike in Wisconsin, and I believe he's on line three. Did you want to punch him up, or do you want me to? Okay, Mike?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great, thank you.
I understand you had a short story for us.
Yeah, well, first of all, you know, I was an infantry soldier in the 1st Cav Division in 1971 in the Central Highlands. And that was going on 40 years ago, 37 years ago. And I never had a chance to thank a Cobra pilot or any of the helicopter pilots because I've never seen them. But I did see them work. And one particular day, we had to be resupplied in a hurry, and they brought in what I was told was a daisy cutter and made an instant LZ for us to be resupplied.
Mm-hmm.
While we were there, one of the listening posts came running in and said, "The Viet Cong are coming." And I was able to sit, and they brought in two Cobra helicopters that worked in a team, and I was able to sit on one side of the perimeter, look across this opening in the jungle, and watch these two helicopters work. I mean, close enough that I could actually see the pilots, you know, the two pilots, their helmets and everything. I never saw such an incredible show in my life of these guys making their runs. And I swear, I mean, it's been a long time, and, you know, the fish always gets bigger after years, but these guys would make a pass, and I swear these helicopters, these Cobras would go up and almost go completely upside down and turn around and come back and make another pass as they worked in teams. And I remember to this day not all of the details of exactly what happened there, but I do remember this. We were never engaged by the Viet Cong. Some of my friends and I think they're still running north if they survived. And the other thing is, I don't know if you guys have ever been thanked for something that most people aren't aware of, and that was the high morale that you guys gave us, knowing that you were there to help us when we needed you. So from the bottom of my heart, this is after 37 years, I'm just grateful to say thank you to you guys.
Well, thank you very much, Mike, and I hope you're enjoying the program. And I'm sure that Randy and the rest of the pilots out there do appreciate that, because we all felt that we had a real job that we had to do.
Well, you did, and I am living proof, number one, to be here to thank you, and we saw it, and just incredible machines. And when I look at the website and see that the medals you guys won for honor, I don't think they come even close to saying the honor and the valor that you guys really, really put out for the infantry soldiers. So thanks again.
Well, thank you very much, Mike.
Thank you, Mike.
Well, it's always interesting when we hear from the people that are on the ground, because we always feel that they're the ones that did most of the work.
Absolutely.
I want to bring on Mike Brown right now. I don't want to miss out on his story. And Mike Brown is also, he's a captain in Vietnam in 1972. And Mike, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning. I know it's pretty early out where you are. You're also in Washington, aren't you?
I'm in Washington State, yes.
Okay. Well, were you part of the CAV also?
Yes, I was. I was with what was left of the CAV when I got there in 1971. Two brigades had been sent home, and the remaining brigade was left with a kind of a proportionate complement of support. And I was assigned a unit that was redesignated that had been Charlie Battery, 2nd of the 20th Artillery, AFA, Aerial Field Artillery, and it had been renamed F Battery, 79th Artillery. And so it was a separate battery, and we were actually assigned to Division Artillery and not Aviation. That changed a little later on. We reverted to the, as the troop drawdown continued, the CAV reduced in size, the separate brigade, and became Task Force Gary Owen, which was not really much bigger than an oversized battalion. Hmm. And F Battery 79th was the aerial field artillery support. And at that time, we were assigned to 229th Aviation, or Combat Aviation Battalion.
Well, Mike, I want you to tell us, if you could, what happened to you and your aircraft on 21 June 1972?
Okay. We were supporting an extraction of an Arvin Brigade off of Highway 13, just a couple of miles south of a place called Anlock. I think Randy Zahn is probably familiar with the city of Anlock, just listening to his piece a little bit. He was operating out of the Quan Loi area, and just east of the fishhook of Cambodia. Anlock is right in that same area.
I think all three of us were in the same place, just at different times.
And Anlock at this time, it was probably one of the, if not the biggest battle of the Vietnam War, it was one of the biggest. And at that time, the ground forces were all Vietnamese. All the American ground forces had gone home. And we had American advisors, and basically the battle was supported by American air, including Cobra helicopters. We were supporting an extraction by other elements of the 229th Aviation to take Vietnamese troops out of off of Highway 13. We were inserting fresh troops and extracting other troops. And we had three Cobra helicopters, what we called a heavy fire team, supporting this insertion extraction. And we were in a known missile environment, But there hadn't been a missile fired in about a month. And we knew that the NVA didn't have an unlimited supply of these things, but they hadn't fired any in about a month. They had previously fired quite a few of them during the height of the Battle of Anlach, and we had lost several ships. We had lost two Cobras known to be taken out by surface-to-air missiles, SA-7s, and several other units had also lost helicopters, mainly Cobras, and nobody had ever survived one. Typically what happened was that the Cobra would be hit by the missile, and the missile would either get a direct trajectory right into the tailpipe of the Cobra engine, and the resulting explosion would blow the helicopter to bits in midair, or it would get a quartering angle and not quite, it wouldn't be able to maneuver into the stack, and it would knock the tail boom off of the aircraft. That was those were the two scenarios. And if the tail boom went off, what typically happened was is that the front half of the helicopter would be left with the tail boom falling, and the front half would spin out of control and crash to the ground. During the fog of everything that was going on, there weren't a lot of eyewitnesses to these. There were some people who were able to get glances at what was happening and that kind of thing, but piecing it together, that was what we were able to determine what was happening. At first, when this started happening, there seemed to be an agenda for denying that there were missiles in the area. Mm-hmm. And we heard things like maybe it was B-40 rockets and maybe other causes and everything but a missile. But most of the people that were there insisted that missiles were being fired. I'm not sure why the seeming denial of the presence of missiles, but that's what it was. It seemed a little strange to be having B-40 rockets firing up and hitting birds at 3,000 feet, but that didn't seem to be require explanation. But
so you were anyway. You were at 4,000 feet.
I was at 4,000 feet. Yeah. Now the situation where we were tactically, as I said, we were supporting a insertion extraction, and we had. Two of our birds were flying essentially with the Slicks, and Slicks is what we called the Huey transport birds that were actually doing
the heavy lifting.
Yeah, they were the ones that were going down and landing and going through the mortar fire and all that good stuff on the ground, putting troops in and taking troops out. And we had two Cobras were with them. Of course, they didn't land. They stayed in the air, but they flew at whatever altitude the Hueys were at, and they basically flew in circles around the Huey formation, protecting them all the time they were exposed. And I was in the high Cobra, basically overlooking the entire scene. I was supposedly support for the two Cobras on the ground, and I was up high where I could see everything that was going on. Well, they turned out to be my support. We were going along, and there was occasional fire on the LZ, and we were used to that. It was essentially any time we went there, it was a hot LZ. But the low Cobras were doing their job, and what I was doing was I was up high. Occasionally, I'd lower my nose and I'd drop a rocket in. I say a rocket. I put two or three pairs of rockets down somewhere near the vicinity where I thought bad guys might be hiding, near the vicinity of the LZ. I apparently found them. on one of my runs, I was coming from the southeast to the northeast across Highway 13 and sort of business as usual, and I put down a few pairs of rockets, and I was climbing out from my run. And in these runs, I'd started about 4,500 feet and fire a few rounds and then pull out at the bottom of the run, somewhere usually at or above 3,000 feet. And on this particular occasion, I was heading southeast to northwest and had expended a couple of rockets and was turning to the right back to the northeast and climbing out. And I heard over the radio a desperate call, almost missile, missile, missile. And it was Ron Tusey, God rest his soul, who was in one of the low Cobras, and he had seen the missile fired, and he yelled, missile, missile, missile. And at that point, I was actually almost turned back toward the southeast, and I looked over my left shoulder, and I could see this kind of spiraling white smoke trail heading for me. There wasn't anybody else there, so there wasn't a lot of thought about, well, maybe that's going somewhere else. And there was no question where it was heading. And so I immediately lowered the collective, which is what you control your power on the Cobra. I took all the power off, lowered the collective, rolled off the throttle to what we call flight idle. Doesn't shut off the engine, but it takes all the torque off the engine. And I began to go into a steep left turn, diving toward the missile. I'd read someplace that Israeli F-4s, one of their tactics against missiles was to try to outmaneuver it by diving the F-4 in the direction that the missile was being fired from. Seemed like a pretty good idea, but an F-4 has a little bit more speed to work with than a Cobra does. Anyway, I started through this turn and got through what I describe as about 3 degrees a turn, and there was a thunk just outside the helicopter. It didn't feel like it was, didn't feel like it touched the helicopter. It felt like it was somewhere in the vicinity of the helicopter. Didn't see it, heard it, and at that point, as I said, I had all the torque off, and I had the rotor pitch in a flat position prepared for auto rotation. And as the missile, or as the explosion became effective, the helicopter jostled a little bit in the air, pitched forward and backward a couple of times, and then it began to want to sink forward, and as you pulled the cyclic, I knew what was happening. And
I got to jump in here for just a second, Mike. We're up against a clock here, and I need to take a break. So hold that. We've been hit by the missile. When we come back, we'll figure out how you got to the ground. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
Gary Lilly & Associates is now Sperry Van Ness Lilly & Associates, the newest Michigan affiliate of a leader in the commercial real estate industry, Sperry Van Ness. More than 800 Sperry Van Ness advisors in 136 markets sold nearly $11 billion in commercial real estate last year. That was done by putting the client's interest first, thereby generating maximum return for every property. When we list a property, we immediately place it on 6 internet commercial listing services and email it to 40,000 prospective buyers and 60,000 commercial brokers. We offer to split the commission 50-50. That means your interests, not ours, are placed first. To learn more, call Sperry Van Ness Lilly & Associates Commercial Realtors at 800-3454. That's 800-345-6694. Be advised, there is a difference.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
And we're back on Veterans Radio. We're talking to a couple of Cobra pilots here. Randy Zahn, the author of Snake Pilot, flying the Cobra attack helicopter in Vietnam, and Mike Brown. And Mike was just telling us how his tail boom got blown off at 4,000 feet by a missile. And how did you get down to the ground, Mike?
Okay, as I said, I was already in position to do an auto rotation. I already knew that I was going to have my center of gravity shooting straight forward, and so I had the cyclic pulled all the way back against the stops as far as I could pull it, and we began to sink down toward the ground. It didn't feel like it was skids level. The witnesses indicated that it looked skids level, but it felt like it was going to want to tuck forward, and we started spin around the mast very, very slowly, and I say this was because the torque was already off the engine. If the torque hadn't been off, our spin would have been much faster. But we started to spin about the mast, and the path of the bird started to describe a big spiraling descent, much like an oak leaf would look if it died and fell from a tree falling to the ground. And about the first circuit around the spiral, the first thing we saw looking forward out of the canopy of the helicopter was our tail boom falling, all probably a couple hundred meters away. And it was tumbling straight down. So it was pretty stark. We knew what had happened for sure at that point. Started to do things to try to help ourselves. The first thing, of course, was to try to get a Mayday call out, and there was no response to that. Obviously, the radios didn't work. And I've never been able to explain it, but I did have intercom, and I was able to talk with my gunner co-pilot in the front seat, Marco Cordone. And I told him to start firing, to start firing out the turret weapons, which are the 7.62 minigun and the 400-meter grenade launcher. And, of course, with no electricity, it was not possible to fire out the turret guns. I then tried to, when I got to a point where I knew I wasn't pointed toward friendlies, I tried to fire some rockets, and that didn't work either. And probably a blessing that it didn't work, because I'd have probably done something like cause an unusual yaw situation or something like that. But then tried to the Cobra's equipped with explosive bolts that hold the rocket pods on the stub wings, and those are ignited electrically. And I tried to activate the explosive bolts, and that didn't work. So nothing worked in terms of trying to get rid of extra weight caused by the ammunition that we had on board.
How fast were you falling?
I couldn't. It was a normal auto rotation, and I wasn't, I have to say, the only thing I was looking at instrument-wise was watching the RPM on the rotor. I wanted to keep that in the green arc.
So I wasn't watching the
rate of descent.
And so you're in a normal auto rotation, just that you were spinning.
Yeah, I would say that while I had the flat pitch, I probably was up close to 4,000 feet a minute, but it's probably less than that. But that would have been about the speed that I would have been following in an auto rotation, and it wasn't any faster than that. And again, it was a lazy arc. Well, at that point, when nothing worked in terms of getting rid of weight, basically just rode it down. I was able to talk to Marco, and thoughts going down. Just pretty much knowing that as soon as impact occurred that we were going to be done. That was basically going to be the end of our lives. And thought about the things that one would normally think about in that situation, family, my wife, my child, and and that type of thing, and I'm sure Marco thought the same kinds of things. And we came down and basically never stopped. As got to the treetops, pulled the collective back up as far as I could pull it, to slow the descent, which is normal procedure for an auto rotation. And we landed in a small grove of trees. There was jungle around there, but the trees weren't that particularly thick where we were. And as we did this and came down through the trees, we slammed up against one particularly tall tree, and that stopped the rotation of the bird. We began to go down alongside this tree, chopped the rotor blades off as we went down, and the branches, each successive branch that we hit going down, slowed us down a little bit more. And at the bottom was a very, very large patch of over-mature bamboo. And when bamboo gets past its prime, it begins not to grow straight up, but bends over and literally grows horizontally. So what we hit on was a patch of overgrown bamboo that was in a horizontal orientation and basically formed a big bed spring on which we landed. And when we landed, it was more violent than I can remember. Marco was injured. We didn't know that at the time, but he had some compressed vertebrae. Compressed discs and broke three vertebrae on impact.
Yeah.
I was supposedly uninjured. As far as I knew, I was uninjured. And my door was jammed. Marco's wasn't. He was able to get right out. Came around to my canopy to try to get in, and we couldn't get mine open. So I chopped out with a breakout knife, and we got out. Out of the bird, the engine was still running when we got out, and we were across a small clearing, and the clearing was littered with the NVA version of sea rations, actually the Chinese version that the NVA had. They were all labeled with Chinese characters, and got across the small clearing into a tree line where we were going to hide. And first thing we saw when we got in the tree line was a bunker that looked like it was about 15 feet by 15 feet. It looked like a huge bunker, thankfully unoccupied. And I looked around. There were several more further back in the trees. None of them are occupied at the moment. And we waited there until I tried to call somebody using my survival radio, and I couldn't get any response. It wasn't working. And
I got to interrupt you. I'm sorry, Mike. Glad that you got down safely. Suddenly, we're out of time again. And the caller that's waiting on the phone, I'm sorry, we'll get to you next time. But I want to thank both of you for being on the program. Mike Brown, for that incredible story of surviving without your tail boom. I don't know how you did that. Randy, thank you very much. For talking with us about your book, Snake Pilot. You can find this on our website. You can go to Amazon to get a copy of it, or through Potomac Books, correct?
Correct. Thank you very much for having me. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. We'll have to get you back on again. I promise you that sometime in the future.
I'd love to.
Again, thank you, Mike. Destiny, thank you very much. You hung up in the studio the whole time, and I want people to remember to go to her website or to her email address to send cards and send money and all those different things. And thank you very much. We'll put that information up there also. Thank you. I want to thank all of our sponsors. You heard all the ads. I don't have time to go through them all. Next week, I think we're going to take a look at some of the other people that were involved with the Battle of Iwo Jima. And not just the Marines were there, the Coast Guard, the Army, Air Corps, and so forth. So we're going to talk about that. We'll be back next week. You are dismissed.
The opinions expressed on this program are those of our guests and are not necessarily those of Veterans Radio or this station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.